Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, we are proud to welcome Tom Wheeler, author, guitar historian, and professor. Tom has written countless guitar books, including the Stratocaster Chronicles, The Soul of Tone, American Guitars, The Dream Factory, and most recently, The Fender Archives. Tom is also a professor at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. Flow Guitar Enthusiasts is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show for you tonight. Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
Well, normally I say I'm doing okay, but I have to say I am about, if I'm lucky, I'm 80%. I have been suffering from the stomach flu for the past week, and it is a beast, I have to say. It's one of the worst I've ever had.
They seem to be, every year the flu gets worse and worse and worse. It seems like it changed. But I'm glad you're feeling better to come down and do the show.
Yeah, well,
you look okay.
The good news, well, of course I look good. I'll tell you why. The good news is I lost 11 pounds in 3 days. That's how much of a stomach flu I had.
Wow. Wow.
It was crazy. But I did get one video done. I got one video done from NAMM, and it was the Orange Crush series from Orange Amps. So that's posted up just today, I think. So that's featuring Aid Emsley, their head engineer at Orange Amps. So that's really cool. Check out my YouTube channel at Selenium. And sorry I didn't get more up, but I was
That's all right.
Busy.
You're allowed. You're allowed. But I'm glad you're feeling better. Anyway, let's go ahead to commercial. We got so much to cover tonight, and this Tom's a great. The books are fascinating. There's a lot of information there. We'll be right back after this, and we'll be with Tom Wheeler.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at Sweetwater.com, or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red apply now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying rock on with the Flow.
All right, everyone, you are listening to Jeff and Scott on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, and I'm Paul Reed Smith from PRS Guitars, and that's kind of what's going on. Enjoy the show.
All right, well, welcome back, everyone. And so I want to welcome our guest tonight, Tom Wheeler. Now, I want to say, when we started this show, which I have to also mention, next week will be our two-year anniversary. When we started this 2 years ago, this was one of the guests I had mentioned to Jeff that I wanted to have because of the fantastic books this guy writes. And if there's anyone out there that knows Fender, this guy knows Fender besides knowing everything else, but this guy knows... This guy has spent the last 10 years Fender. But... I want to welcome Tom Wheeler. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, honored to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Well, to get started, can you kind of give us your backstory of kind of how you got started into writing all these guitar books and you know, how you came into where you're at now?
Sure. I was in law school and teaching guitar. And my students and their moms and dads would ask me the same questions over and over. How do you buy a guitar? And how do you take care of a guitar? So I just printed up a couple of sheets of tips to pass out. My first book was reviewed by Rolling Stone. The short version is, and they asked me if I would write for them, which was a huge thrill. And then I went to work for Guitar Player and was there for 14 years full time. And I was editor-in-chief of Guitar Player for the last 10 years. And then I joined the faculty here at the University of Oregon. And I've continued to stay active, to write magazine articles and to write books and to keep my contacts with my good friends in the music business.
Yeah, I even saw in your bio that you you contributed a couple chapters to one of the books that I one of the first guitar books I had bought that I guess has turned out to be fairly valuable, but it's the book on Gibson 100 years from around, I think, 94 or 96, something like that.
Yeah, I wrote four or five chapters for that book on Les Paul and other chapters, and that was a great honor. That was put together by Walter Carter, whom I admire. He was the Gibson historian at the time, and that's one of about a dozen books, I guess, I've contributed to, aside from the ones I've written myself.
Now, before we kind of get into your books, while we're experiencing the time where you were out, I was kind of describing the Fender Archives book for everybody. But before we get into your books that you've written, mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to bring up, we were talking earlier about a recent event where an actual Les Paul guitar owned by Les Paul went up for auction. Owned by Tom Doyle, which is his guitar tech. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit of controversy with that because it's a Black Beauty that was owned by Les Paul.
Yep.
And there's two philosophies that people are looking at it. They're looking at it as it's a bogus guitar that was just essentially owned by Les Paul, or it's the holy grail of all Les Pauls. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I think, in all honesty, the facts are well documented. I don't think it's much of a debate. I think that guitar was reported to be a 54. It's a late 53. It's a custom. There was some implication that Gibson had delivered a few guitars to Les prior to this one. That's very misleading. Gibson was manufacturing Les Paul Gold Tops since 1952. And those guitars were, as I say, manufactured, retailed, cataloged, advertised. So this notion that not much happened prior to the Les Paul custom in late 53 or 54 is, you know, again, everybody kind of knows that's not true. I think what happened was Tom Doyle, whom I admire and is an honorable man, has a particular take on why this guitar is important. And I've corresponded with him about this, and I chatted with him at the NAMM show. My problem was with Guitar Player and the way the story was presented. And there are just a number of things in there. And then the story was picked up by the New York Times, who got it wrong, the Wall Street Journal, who got it wrong. I have to tell you, as a journalism professor, this is a sad thing. So some of the implications in these various publications were that this is the most famous Les Paul of all time. Well, that's false because most people have never heard of this guitar until now. It's not famous at all,
right?
Let alone, I mean, it is now, but it was hardly the most famous Les Paul of all time. Second, this notion that it made possible all of the other Les Pauls that followed, perhaps because of the tune-o-matic bridge, which can't be true. Thousands of Les Pauls don't have tune-o-matic bridges.
Well, that guitar didn't even have a tune-o-matic bridge as sold. It was sold with the Bigsby, right?
Exactly, right. But, and of course, that guitar was basically a test mule that Les, whom I admired no end, I love that guy, and he was changing stuff around all the time. I think what Tom was getting at, and again, I consider him to be an honorable person, was that because that guitar made Les happy and had the corrected neck angle relative to the body and had the tunematic bridge, which Les liked, and they had gotten rid of the trapeze prior to that, I think what Tom is saying is that because those things came together, that's what Les Paul wanted. For that reason, if I understand Tom correctly, that made it some kind of original guitar that made other Les Pauls possible. But it was a custom. Most people think of standards, Sunbursts, as holy grails. Some of the publications who picked up the story talked about Les Paul having designed the guitar, which was false. Les didn't design that guitar. And this, frankly, takes nothing away from Les Paul, again, whom I admire deeply. If anything, I think Les Paul is probably underrated by the general public, given his genius, his work with sound on sound and multi-tracking. But that guitar, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but
love Les Paul, so I wouldn't mind talking about this.
well, the design of that guitar, and again, this is there's nothing controversial about this. These facts have been documented in a whole stack of books that have been out there for decades. And if it's too much trouble for these reporters to consult a book, they can go to Wikipedia, for heaven's sakes. Take 10 seconds and Google Gibson Les Paul guitar wiki. Wikipedia got it right. Fender was starting to have some success in 1950 and 51 with its Telecaster and its predecessors, the Esquire and the Broadcaster. Ted McCarty, who was running Gibson, looked at that success and, against the advice of his friends, decided that Gibson would make a solid body guitar as well. He and his staff designed that guitar. They took it to Les. Les had never seen it. But Les had, years and years before, pioneered and championed the notion of a solid body guitar. To my knowledge, he never built anything prior to the debut of the Les Paul guitar that looked anything like a Les Paul. He built this log that was basically a board with wings from a guitar body attached to it. He was just trying to prove that this was a viable way to go. And I talked to Ted McCarty at length about this. Talked to Les as well. And Ted took the guitar to Les. Now, Les did get involved with the colors, the black versus the gold. With the woods, was it going to be solid mahogany? Was it going to be mahogany with a maple cap? They went back and forth about the tailpiece. But that guitar was endorsed by Les Paul, and he was the perfect person because he was a genius. He was innovative. He was a huge star. He was a fabulous guitar player. And for years, he had been championing the notion of a solid body guitar. So he was absolutely the best person on the planet to go see about an endorsement deal. And again, there's no debate about any of this stuff. So what I think the controversy was simply an interpretation about the importance of Tom Doyle's guitar. And let me say, that guitar is fascinating. It's valuable. It's historically significant. But a lot of these reporters got it wrong. It wasn't the most famous Les Paul ever. It could hardly be called the genesis of all the Les Pauls that followed, given the fact that Les Paul or the Gibson had already been making guitars for a couple of years. Les didn't design it. So there's just been a lot of misconceptions, and I don't fault Tom. I fault my fellow journalists.
Do you think the price that it sold for was fair at $335,000? $335,000, I should say.
Well, it's hard to say because it's worth what someone will pay for it. Some friends of mine and I were just emailing back and forth. You know, given the controversy, what do you think this thing might go for? That's impossible to say. I know some people were saying, oh, it's $1 million or it's $2 million. Joe Bonamassa was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, I would not spend $10,000 for this guitar. So that's anybody's guess. You know, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan said one time, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. And again, the timeline of the Les Paul is very well documented.
Yeah. Well, I think the, you know, two or three guitars I would say that would, I think, would be more closer to a holy grail for a Les Paul-owned guitar, not necessarily a Genesis Les Paul, would be one of his clunkers, and one of those did go up for auction in his Les Paul auction. Because those were definitely what he worked on the most.
And, you know, holy grail is a completely subjective term. And so, to some extent, I think it's silly to say this Les Paul is the holy grail. No, you're wrong. That Les Paul is the holy grail. The holy grail is in the mind of the beholder. So some people might say, well, an iconic guitar such as the Sunburst that Michael Bloomfield is holding on the cover of Super Session, because everybody saw that guitar and said, what is that that our hero Michael is playing? Or a guitar that is famous by virtue of a recording. You know, Leslie West played a junior on Mississippi Queen. Well, if that's your holy grail, fine. Who's to argue? Or how about the red Les Paul that was a gift? It was owned by both George Harrison and Eric Clapton. And I believe, if I recall correctly, that's the guitar that Eric Clapton played While My Guitar Gently Weeps, or Duane Allman's Tobacco Sunburst, or Jimmy Page's Led Zeppelin. You know, how's that for a holy grail Les Paul? It's in the mind of the individual, and I wouldn't argue with any of those. However, I will say this. I think there should be some relation between a guitar that is called the holy grail and at least, you know, it should be remotely connected to conventional opinions about what constitutes a holy grail, whichever opinion you happen to ascribe to. So a guitar that most people have never heard of, and in my view, clearly, well, according to fact, clearly did not make all Les Pauls possible and all that sort of stuff. I wouldn't call it a holy grail. If somebody else wants to, it's fine with me. What I wish Guitar Player had done, say, Tom Doyle owns a really interesting Les Paul, and we know the conventional wisdom, but Les owned this particular guitar, and here's what he thought. Les had a different view. He felt this was the one guitar that made everything pop. Well, that would have been a perfectly legitimate article, and it's one that I would have very much enjoyed reading.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it was I had not seen my Facebook thing light up over something like that in a long time. It was pretty fun to watch, but
well, one of the things that's sad about it is keeping the discussion on track. You know, I read some postings. Well, Tom Doyle knew Les Paul better than anybody. That's true. Are you kidding? He worked side by side with Les for 40 some years, which surely must have given him some insights that nobody else had. I wish the article had pursued that. Again, this is a fascinating guitar. I think it's a shame that because some people made some rather wild interpretations, if anything, it might have hurt the value of the guitar. And that's just speculative. I, you know, who can say? I can't say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I went to the auction to see the Les Paul Estate, I mean, I was kind of shocked at what some of those guitars went for. I didn't think they went for what I thought they would have gone for with the history that they had. I mean, mm-hmm. the highest one that went, the highest selling guitar was even a Les Paul. It was a very early Fender, I think it was a Nocaster, I believe. It didn't have Broadcaster, so it was early Nocaster with signed by Leo Fender, Paul Bigsby, and Les Paul.
Wow. What did that go for?
$250,000.
Yeah. Okay.
It was 52, I think. They were a little sketchy on the year. They tried to claim it was a prototype, but then everyone was like, no, that's not a prototype.
Not if it's a 52.
Yeah. But anyways, it was an interesting guitar. I mean, but, you know, I was kind of shocked that only went for $250,000, but then I was shocked that, you know, his other guitars that people were really associated with him is those recording guitars that he played all the time at the Iridium and Fat Tuesdays. I think the highest one there was the Sunburst one he had, went for like $175,000.
You know, I think one of the things this might tell us is it might be a generational thing, and how important it is that a guitar is associated with particular performances. If you look at Blackie, for example, and Brownie, the Layla guitar, the two Strats that were sold, or, you know, the Woodstock Strat, the white Strat that Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner on, those associations with landmark performances, I think, have a lot to do with the value of those guitars. Let me just say one more thing about Les Paul. Mm-hmm. I just want to make it clear. He sent me an autographed photograph with a personal comment on it that I have on my wall and that I cherish. My admiration for him knew no bounds. He was kind enough to write the foreword for American Guitars. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, I think if anything, he's probably underrated by the general public. And so I just wanted to make it clear, as far as I'm concerned, this controversy about the recently auctioned guitar is simply about getting our facts straight, and it's not about who knew Les Paul best or any of that sort of nonsense.
Yeah, well, I have to agree. I think I agree with you on the underrated thing, because I've admired that guy for a very long time myself. I mean, it was my, and I even flew out for his 90th birthday at the Iridium Jazz Club, and that was so cool. But
it's pretty great.
Well, so let's talk about some of the recent books that you've written.
Sure.
One of them being the Fender Archives. That's the most recent one that's out. So in doing that, you know, you've been working on Fender books almost exclusively for the past 10 years.
Right.
And when you did this book, what was the one thing that you found that just kind of, you know, blew your mind?
Oh, gosh, I might be able to pick two or three. If I had to pick one, it would be the Freddie Tavares Diaries. Freddie went to work for Leo in 1953 and helped Leo refine the guitar that would become the Stratocaster. He was probably the most admired, loved, really, of all the early Fender principals. And I think Richard Smith, who wrote the single best volume of Fender history called Fender, The Sound Heard Around the World, I think Richard told me that even he was unaware of these journals, but I found a stack of them in a hot warehouse in California, in Corona, not too far from the factory. And Freddie entered 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 or 7 entries every day about what was going on at Fender. And it was absolutely, I mean, to me, this was like the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. It was wonderful to see this in his own hand with, you know, different colored inks, whatever pen he picked up off his table. And it's a mix of kind of mundane personal things, like I had a flat tire on the way to work this morning, accounting for expenses like $3.48 for this or that, And then the next entry will be something like Forrest White resigned today under pressure from Fender sales. I think the most illuminating thing about these diaries was that people who know a little about Fender history know that Fender was acquired by CBS. Negotiations in late 64. It became effective in January 65. And kind of the conventional wisdom is that quality declined under CBS.
Right.
Well, this is one of those cases where the conventional wisdom turns out to be not only true, but in fact, it was worse than we all knew. And I have reprinted a number of pages from Freddie's journal about life under CBS. Everything from bad paint jobs, rejected Utah speakers, rejected Jensen speakers, little details like the latches on 100 cases don't line up, or the corners for the new basement don't fit. Remember that Fender was just starting to work with solid state, and these amplifiers were not good. And the people who had spent so much of their lives making the Fender name stand for quality, it broke their hearts to see what was happening. So along with this litany of catastrophes, you also see entries like, well, we had 100 guitars with defective paint jobs, but the pressure from sales is to put them out anyway. So Freddie's writing, so I went through the stack to pick out the least bad ones. I mean, this is an attitude that would have been unheard of in Leo's shop prior to CBS. And there are many, many such examples. There are some amplifiers that don't sound good. They're bass amps. They're solid state basements. And the entry says, we're told to send them out because bass players probably won't tell the difference. I mean, again, Leo would go berserk if he knew this kind of thing, but he had been pushed off to the side. Well, another thing I'll tell you that's just kind of a fun thing. I found a number of things in Leo's own hand where he was costing out everything, like the screw that holds on the strap button on a Telecaster. Mm-hmm. Leo could tell you the cost of that thing to the 1,000th of a dollar. I mean, some of these things going out 3, 4, I think in some cases, 5 decimal points. And to see this in his own hand, I thought was very revealing.
Wow. Well, I'm looking at those diary entries right here. It looks like they're in chapter 9, it looks like.
Yes.
Of the book. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah, there's another thing that was kind of fun. When I was at Fender in Scottsdale looking through a filing cabinet, I found a letter that was written on like a reporter's notebook, yellow tablet. And it was from some guy out there somewhere who thought he could improve a Stratocaster vibrato. And it was handwritten, and he had these crude drawings. And then I saw the signature, Floyd Rose.
Oh, yeah. That was amazing when I was reading that.
And Fender, of course, rejected it. One of the biggest blunders. And, of course, they then spent the 80s playing catch-up to all these sort of super Strat models that were being introduced by, you know, Kramer and Charvel and Jackson and all these companies, many with Floyd Roses. So these little kinds of insights, contracts, and if you got time for one more, I'll tell you something really kind of staggering.
Sure.
When CBS was considering the purchase of Fender, it was actually Columbia Records, a division of CBS. They hired, as corporations sometimes do, an investigative financial company to look into Fender and to advise them as to whether it's a good idea to purchase this company, which they did. And I found the report. And it advises CBS, yes, this would be a good purchase. But we really recommend, their words were, a sharp diminution in the role of Mr. Fender. In other words, they're saying, buy the company, but kind of elbow this guy off to the side and bring in some efficient corporate managers, and profits will go up. Well, for people who know what happened to quality overall under CBS, these sorts of discoveries were nothing less than staggering for me.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, I think I think those kind of things can be argued for a lot of music companies and corporations. I mean, I think I generally feel that if somebody's name is on the, you know, the outside of that building, that usually things are much better inside.
I think that's often true, and I'm certainly no financial expert, but my impression is, I think this goes, you know, for publishing and guitar manufacturing and all sorts of businesses, corporations respond to their stockholders. And it's not that hard in a quarterly statement, so you're looking at, you know, 3 months. It's not that hard to show an increase in profit for 3 months. If you fire a lot of people, if you cut corners, boy, you can make that bottom line look pretty good. Now, what is the price you pay in the long run? Well, corporations don't often think that way, and we've certainly seen it in the music business.
Yep, absolutely. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you as going through, which I thought was pretty fascinating, was to watch, you know, how you showed the progression of the invention of the Telecaster. And, you know, and I think everybody would, you know, say Leo Fender, of course, was the inventor. But, you know, I think your book shows how important Don Randall was. Can you talk about that? And just, you know, because he really was pushing him.
Yeah. Randall, whom I've called a marketing genius without equal in the history of the music business, at least in the guitar business, and I've said that on more than one occasion, kind of every chance I get. He was sort of the opposite of Leo. Leo was reclusive. He was kind of self-conscious. He liked to stay in the lab. He often wore kind of funky clothes, didn't really care. He just wanted to, you know, sit at that workbench and, you know, design great pickups or whatever he was doing. Randall looked like an astronaut. I mean, he was, you know, he had this air about him. He wore nice suits. He was a pilot. He was handsome. He was personable. And he was a brilliant marketing and sales guy. And the problem was he and his sales team in 1949, were out there taking orders for guitars, and Leo was not building them. Leo was still refining his designs, and so there was tremendous tension. And I found a number of these letters, and it was wonderful to see them. Leo was dithering. It's like, come on already, finish these things and ship them. From Leo's point of view, these sales guys out there in the field had jumped the gun. It's like, I'll finish it when I'm good and ready. So that was the tension. And it was very touch and go. I don't think there's any question that Fender might have failed, even though those guitars proved to be, well, gosh, the Telecaster, probably the longest running success story in electric guitars. They never stopped making them, and they're still making them. But were it not for Don Randall and those salesmen, the whole Fender success story might never have happened.
Now, your book points out that, I cannot remember who the heck said it, but I think it was a famous artist said it, that the early Telecasters were, you know, an obvious, creation from the lap steels, early lap steels.
Oh, yes.
That kind of always, I've always wondered that because, you know, you've got Champ lap steels out there that are selling for like $400 to $1,000, made from, you know, early 50s, same time period when all these guitars are made. And that's what they're going for. And it just blows me away. Is it just because they're a lap steel, but they just seem like they should be a lot more valuable?
Yes. Well, and as to the first part of your question about the influence of lap steels on the Telecaster, for example.
Yeah.
No question. See, one of the things I learned was that I was wrong, and I think a lot of people were wrong about where these guitars came from. I assumed that Leo started with acoustic guitars and tried to electrify them. That's what everybody else was doing.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was already building electric guitars. They were lap steels, and he had started building them since 1946. So for 4 years, he and his partner, Doc Kaufman, and then Fender on his own, were building electric guitars. They were lap steels, and they had matching amplifiers. Now, Leo loved Hawaiian music and country music, and some of his closest friends, like Noel Boggs, were steel players. And so Leo did not start with a conventional acoustic guitar to try to amplify it. He started with the electric lap steels he was already making and figured out a way to flip it upright so you could play it conventionally. For example, it's no accident that the scale length on those Fenders is 25 and a half. It is quite a bit longer than, say, a Les Paul, which was advertised at 24 and three quarters and is actually a little closer to about 24.6. And Leo liked the sound of steel guitars. And his buddies, who were steel guitar players, told him that that longer scale length was where the tone came from. And so he kind of built that into his Esquires and Broadcasters and Telecasters, and that has everything to do with their sound. Tone really begins with scale length. And so that was very much where this guitar came from. And Leo, of course, was looking at everything everybody else was doing. Doc Kaufman, Bixby, Rickenbacker. He was well aware. He would get his hands on anything and everything and, you know, rip it apart and see if there was any ideas in there he wanted to keep.
Yeah, actually, there was a kind of my dad is a lap steel and pedal steel guy, and there's,
oh, cool.
There's a a lot of people argue that there's a 26 inch scale length lap steel that's out there, kind of rare to find. But I think my dad may have one of them or had one at some point and sold it. But you know, a lot of people claim that one sounds good, but it's a little tough to play because they're used to playing a different scale length. But
right,
it's interesting. I mean, yeah, I don't know about the scale length if it does help the tone or not. That's interesting.
Oh, sure it does. Don't take it from me. I mean, the people who tell me this are people like, you know, Jay Black, when he was at the Fender Custom Shop. These guys know what they're doing. And, or Paul Smith could tell you the same thing. You know, there's a reason his standard scale length is 25, you know, right between the conventional Gibson and the conventional Fender scale lengths. Sure, yeah, it has to. I mean, it's just a matter of physics that if you tune a string to a certain pitch, the length of that string will affect how it vibrates.
Now, one of the people I saw kept on cropping up in the book, which I was really shocked and really excited to see them the book and providing stories, was Alexander Dumble. How did you pull that one off?
Holy cow, what a guy. Well, as you may know, he is a legendary figure. And my dear friend Larry Thomas, who was the CEO of Fender at the time, I was visiting Larry and I was interviewing him for this book. And he said, hey, I'm going over to Dumble's. You want to go? I said, sure. Are you kidding? And Alexander and I hit it off immediately. I just found him to be a really compelling person. We shared a number of great stories, and I'm sure you know what his amplifiers are selling for. And his take on tone is really something to behold. And of course, his take on Leo Fender was tremendously insightful. And I didn't know this when I went to visit him. I just wanted to meet him and see, you know, what his house looked like. And sure enough, it's floor-to-ceiling amplifiers everywhere. and his workbench and so on. But what I didn't know was that he had visited Fender and tells that story, and I just decided to make it a whole chapter. I thought it was such a great insight into what Fender was like in the early and mid '60s.
Yeah, I mean, I was really excited to see that, and I thought it was great to hear, you know, how much he admired, you know, I mean, because you know he does, because as we all know, that a lot of his amps are, you know, kind of not based off of, but they are. I mean, they are all based off those early Fenders.
Sure.
And just way improved.
Yeah.
Somehow, whatever magic he's got going on there.
Tom, well, and he remembered so many details. I just thought it was so kind of him to spend that time with me. And he's a big fan of the book as well. He sent me an email and said, I went to Borders or Barnes & Noble, and I bought all of them. He said, they're out of your books now because I bought all of them. He's going to give them away to friends. I really appreciate that.
Thomas, I got a question for you. What was Leo's reaction to all the amps that came out? Because a lot of people, I mean, for even Marshall, he based it on a Bassman. How did he feel about that, or did he have any say on or opinion on that?
I think I have to speculate here. I can tell you what he thought about people who were copying the guitars, because that seemed to be earlier and seemed to be more prominent. He told me one time about how a group of Japanese tourists had come through the factory and were taking flash pictures, as he recalled. Leo, by the way, was an accomplished photographer as well. And he remembered them taking pictures. And my read on it was that he was actually kind of proud that the Stratocaster was being copied so much, because his first guitars were laughed at by other people. And I think this was his way of thinking, well, I guess we showed them, because this is the number one guitar in the world and all these other companies are copying it. I don't think back then that it had dawned on him the long-term financial impact of not trademarking those designs. So I don't know what he felt about the amplifiers. I don't recall ever speaking to him about that. But I think it would be years before Fender tried to trademark those designs.
Well, you know, speaking of that, Jeff, just to mention that, going back to Alexander Dumble, when he visited there, they gave him all the schematics.
Oh, yeah. You can still download the schematics for all the
Well, I know, but this was like, when do you think he visited him? Like in the 60s, would you say?
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, well, a lot of these were from Bell or from Western Electric, and that's where Leo started. And he would take those circuits, and they were widely available. You know, my friend Richie Fliegler pointed out, you know, you can say that everybody had access to those same schematics when they went out, you know, to the lab, when they went out to the shop, but only Leo Fender came back with a Tweed Bassman. Only Leo Fender came back with a Tweed Deluxe, or, you know, a blonde Showman. I mean, these other classic amplifiers. There's a tremendous amount of creativity and ingenuity in those amplifiers, and the way Leo sort of juggled all the factors.
Yeah, I remember back when we, in the 70s or even earlier, with our amps, we would go to Fullerton to the Fenders, and you could buy parts there if you broke parts or whatever, and they would Xerox the schematic for you if you asked for it. It was, I mean, they were very open about it. It wasn't like today, but even today, though, they have it on the website, but they were always like that.
All right. Yeah, they were very open. I visited Fender a number of times, and it was great. Talked to, well, most of the principals, Freddie several times, Leo several times, Bill Carson, Forrest White, all those guys. I think they were kind of surprised. You know, this was really kind of the dawn of guitar history. I think they were sort of tickled and maybe a little surprised that anybody would be interested in what they were doing in 1950 or 1952. No one had ever asked them this stuff before.
Yeah. Well, so I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit and ask you a couple questions dealing with the current times of
sure.
Fender. So what are your thoughts? Because, you know, one of the things that, everybody was kind of buzzing about at NAMM this year was that that Fender's selling directly to people,
right.
essentially going in competition with, all the online folks and dealers. What is your feeling on that?
Well, I'm not an expert, and I've not talked with my pals at Fender recently about that particular topic. I think they would probably say something like this. No music dealer is going to buy from Fender a pink left-handed Telecaster with a left-handed Bixby and a pearl pickguard, because the odds that some guy is going to walk in off the street and want that guitar are about zero. On the other hand, if there is some guy out there who wants that guitar, Fender doesn't want to lose the sale. And so I think they decided to make this available because of the reach of these digital technologies. I think from a retailer's point of view, it's, well, you could have handled this a lot differently. I mean, if you want to sell the left-handed pink Tele, be my guest. But selling our bread and butter instruments is perceived to be quite a blow from dealers who have been loyal to Fender for a long time. So I don't know what's going to happen next, but I think it has to be part of a larger trend. If you look at what's happening to, bookstores and are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, yeah. I just got a little flash on my screen here. If you look at what's happening to bookstores and all sorts of retail, we're seeing this more and more. What I think is particularly annoying and sad, and this isn't new, is when, somebody goes into your local mom and pop music store, which I live in a town. We've got Mackenzie River Music here in Eugene, Oregon, where I live. We're just so lucky to have them. If somebody goes in and takes advantage of the expertise of the salesperson, and they're paying rent, and they're paying the light bill and all this stuff, and then the customer leaves and goes and buys the thing online, that is understandably annoying and really debilitating to your business if you're a retailer. So I just revere my local music store, and I think it's one of the great things about a city is that you've got a place you can go. And I'd really like to see a resurgence in local retail. But, that's happening in all sorts of businesses, books, not just guitars.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, one quick question before we end the show here.
Uh-huh.
So as a guitar historian, what are your thoughts on a guitar company building guitars, keeping the old tradition, kind of building guitars the way they were made 60 years ago and not really deviating from that too much? Or someone, like a good example would be Gibson, doing something completely different and coming out with, guitars that have all kinds of new technology in it, and not only implementing that new technology, but making it standard on all their guitars. What's your feeling on that? Is that the right thing to do, or do you think it's better for a company to still stick with what works?
I think what works. Now, I'm all in favor of innovation, but I think those innovations have to serve a purpose. I think some of these companies have done some pretty goofy things recently, but you look at somebody like Paul Smith, and what PRS has done is stuck very much to tradition, but looking at things as detailed as like the thickness of the plating on the bridge or what kind of washer you have inside the tuning key, And these things, as it turns out, do add up. So I think it's really about tone. It's really about performance. If you pick up that guitar and you can't put it down, I think that's what it's about. And if it's the sound that makes you want to create art, makes you want to make art, if you, you know, see God or have fun or express yourself and make art, then whatever gets you there is important. And for some people, it's going to be something we've never seen before with a lot of bells and whistles. And for some people, it's going to be an old Telecaster.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show. We're coming to the end. Is there a website that people can visit to learn more about you?
No, you know, I've stayed away from having a guitar-related website, but my books are all available on Amazon. I should probably get one of my sharp students to teach me how to do that. But if you just Google my name and guitar, all of my books will come up.
Yeah, definitely, folks. If you haven't checked out his books, definitely check them out. They're not just, you know, guitar porn. They're actually full on information. I mean, the books are amazing, and this the Fender Archives book is a great book too, with all kinds of cool stuff in it. You got to check
it out. Thank you so much. I appreciate you saying that.
Yes, thank you. Well, hang on at the end, and we'll talk to you at the once we're off air.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good.